Join me, Kevin Kelly, host of Morning Classical Music on WILL and music director of the Prairie Ensemble for the WILL-FM Concert in the Park. The Prairie Ensemble will perform music by Walton, Mozart, and Mendelssohn. The concert begins at 5 with Celtic music by the Academy of Irish Music. Bring a picnic or buy food from our grill. Join us Saturday at Allerton Park. WILL-FM's Concert in the Park is underwritten by the Illinois Arts Council, a state agency, and Kent and Lisa Shirley of Twin City Honda BMW. You're listening to WILL Urbana.
Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, Henry Frayne is at the controls. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we will talk with E.J. Dionne. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and also columnist for the Washington Post, frequent commentator on politics on National Public Radio. We will talk about a new book that he's authored. It's titled Stand Up, Fight Back, Republican Toughs, Democratic Wimps, and the Politics of Revenge. Then in hour two, well, welcome back to the program, Rich Warren. He is a syndicated columnist who writes about consumer electronics. His column that appears in our newspaper, the News Gazette, has written for other national publications, including Sound and Vision. And every once in a while, he is here on the program and talks a little bit about what's new in the way of TV and DVDs and other things that have to do with audio and video. That's tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the funding of terrorism. And our guest for the program is Douglas Farah. He's been an award-winning member of the investigative staff and foreign correspondent for The Washington Post and other publications. In March of 2000, he was named by The Post to be West Africa bureau chief and was stationed in Abidjan in the Ivory Coast until threats on his life forced him and his family to evacuate. Since January of 2004, he's worked as a consultant and senior fellow at the National Strategy Information Center, writing on national intelligence matters. And he's been looking into, for some time, this question of the financing of terrorism. As reporters and other kinds of investigators have looked at the terrorist attacks of 9/11, they understand how it is that the money got from Al-Qaeda to the hijackers. They have managed to trace it back to the top money guy in Al-Qaeda. However, back further than that, they don't have any things. They don't really understand very well where the money comes from and how it gets moved around. And how Doug Farah got into this was when he was in Africa, stumbled upon the fact that Al-Qaeda was laundering its funds by using diamonds from Sierra Leone and also another country there. And my apologies, Liberia, Liberian Sierra Leone. I blanked on it just there for a moment. He writes all about this in his book, Blood from Stones, The Secret Financial Network of Terror. And it's published by Broadway Books, out now. Questions and comments are welcome here as we talk with Douglas Farah. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, Mr. Farah, hello.
Well, hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it very much. Maybe we talked this a little bit about how it is that you got onto this story when you were in Africa.
Well, it happened through a bizarre set of circumstances. I was investigating the diamond industry because it was clear that the brutal wars in both Liberia and Sierra Leone were driven by the desire for diamonds, and particularly former President Charles Taylor of Liberia's desire to control the diamond fields. And in researching this, some of Taylor's close associates identified the Al-Qaeda connection there for me, looking at some of the pictures of the most wanted terrorists that had come out after 9/11. I was actually investigating a Hezbollah connection at that point, and it turned out to be both Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda.
Hmm. There was, I guess, a major change in how it is that Al-Qaeda, if I'm just going to take that group, handled its financing. That is, say, if you look back to the late 90s, they apparently were using banks. They were using some more conventional ways of storing and transferring money, and that it was only after the Clinton administration froze assets, several hundred million dollars worth of assets that were held in Western banks, that al-Qaeda decided that they needed to do something differently.
Well, al-Qaeda, I think, is a very smart and very adaptable organization. And when the United States, following the bombings of the two U.S. embassies in East Africa, thrashed around to find something to do in response, they froze the Taliban and al-Qaeda money, not realizing at the time that, in fact, the Taliban had deposited $220 million in gold in the U.S. Federal Reserve System. So they were able to hurt al-Qaeda and the Taliban substantially at that point. And al-Qaeda subsequently decided, as it reviews its operations after everything it does, that this was a huge mistake and it wouldn't happen again. And they began siphoning their money out of the formal banking structure and traceable means and freezable assets into things like diamonds and tanzanite, which are very easy to transport. You can hold very high value in a very small package of diamonds or tanzanite. Easy to move, very easy to convert back into cash when you need it. You don't raise any alarms. Dogs can't sniff them. The metal detector doesn't go off when you go through airports. It was a very well thought out and very methodical step they took to protect their assets.
And this was something that you argue in the book, that intelligence, both in this country and in Europe, this change in tactic was something that they completely missed.
Yes, they're still, and to a degree they still do. They still like to look for bank accounts and wire transfers because it's something that they understand and are familiar with. Commodities is new. The way they move and the industries through which they move are opaque by design in the case of diamonds, so they're hard to get into. And it was just a whole different way of doing things that that escaped attention, partly because no one was looking.
This also involves something else that I have heard a little bits about here now and then, and perhaps some people will be familiar with, and that is this network of financial brokers, essentially, that exists in the Arab world and also in Asia, a way of moving money around where actually money itself doesn't really move. And it's, again, a system that actually for people for a long time has worked really well. And yet also if you're interested in trying to trace money that might be the money of terrorist organizations, it doesn't have the kind of transparency that the modern Western banking system has, that it makes it really very difficult to follow the money in effect. And perhaps you can talk about that.
Well, yes, it's the hawala system and the derivatives of that, where, as you said correctly, you move money without ever actually moving money. It's generally you have cash-intensive businesses in different parts of the world, and the value of hawala is great because essentially a hawala dealer or someone in the hawala network can deliver cash to remote regions of Pakistan or into Afghanistan where either there are no banks or banks would charge a huge commission. It makes the money traceable when you put it through banks, therefore taxable. So people can move money, and the vast majority of the people who use this are expatriate workers on the Arab Peninsula or in the United States, sending money back to their very poor families back in India and Pakistan and elsewhere. So it's not a bad system in and of itself. But it leaves, as you said, no paper trail. It's something that we're only now beginning to culturally understand on the intelligence side in this country and beginning to come to terms with the need to at least understand the system to try to get at the abuses that can take place in there. But it's not a new system. It's just, again, that no one was looking there and no one paid any attention to it.
Well, it seems that then if the mission of Western intelligence services is to try to trace the money and find out how it's moved and where it goes and in effect try to get on top of that and limit the movement, limit the ability of terrorist organizations to fund their operations, and if they're doing it in these ways that are so difficult to trace, it makes you wonder whether, in fact, it is, as the president promised back after 9/11, it's actually possible to get at these terrorist organizations by choking off their finances.
Well, it's difficult, and it involves acknowledging a paradigm shift in how we look at them and understanding how adaptable and flexible they are. One of the things I had in the book, which I was astounded when I found when people were telling me this, is that despite the fact that Al-Qaeda came into existence in 1988 and had carried out a series of actions against the United States, it wasn't until 1999, 11 years later, that the Clinton administration asked for an all-source intelligence estimate of the financial structure of Al-Qaeda. So for 11 years, they didn't even really look at it. They assumed bin Laden was writing personal checks and paying for things. And then subsequent to that, Director Tenet of the CIA told the 9/11 Commission that, in fact, they didn't look at the entire structure of Al-Qaeda until the same time they looked at the financial structure, 11 years after its existence. So that shows you how, I would say, set in their ways the intelligence community was in looking at these groups and their inability to look beyond what they assumed they knew at the realities on the ground.
Hmm. Are we doing any better now than we were a couple of years ago?
Yes, there's been a substantial shift. Unfortunately, as happens often in these things, we're fighting the last war. People are now beginning to look at hawala and commodity structures as ways in which terrorists move their money or store their value. Where, for all we know now, the terrorist organizations have moved on to other mechanisms as we become more aware of these or try to control these. But what's really difficult, for example, in the diamond trade, my research in Sierra Leone and Liberia pointed to them perhaps getting $30 to $50 million put into diamonds in the 8 months before the 9/11 period. It's a lot of money, but if you're looking at a $7 billion industry, how do you get at that? You can't shut down the diamond industry to get less than 1% that might be dirty. They use gold extensively, but you can't close down the diamond, the gold industry. Hawala is vulnerable, but it moves literally, I think, to India. The numbers are $600 billion a year going to India alone through the hawala system. So you can't shut that down without bringing that economy to a screeching halt. So my argument is that what you really need to do is have much better intelligence on the ground in the areas of the world, like Liberia and Sierra Leone, which are essentially failed states or functioning criminal enterprises set up as states, and on the ground figure out what's happening and not try to punish the entire community that does these other things.
Hmm. Well, we here have been talking about how it is that an organization like Al-Qaeda can move money around. Have you gone and also looked at this other question of where the money comes from in the first place?
Well, the diamond phase, the diamond operation had two phases to it. One was to make money, and then in the months before 9/11, it was simply to buy as many diamonds as they could out of Sierra Leone and Liberia to preserve their finances in assets in that commodity. But I think the consensus is, and it's certainly my sense that this is probably still true, that they rely heavily on charitable organizations that will siphon funds off to them and individual specific donors who have long been favorable to their cause and are willing to continue to give money. And I think when you were asking in the previous question if we've gotten better, that's where we've gotten better. It is now much more difficult for Islamic charities, and the vast majority do almost entirely good work. It's a few charities that siphon off a small portion, again, of their funds to support terrorism, and that's become more difficult. And they've also had some success in identifying some of the larger donors and at least putting them on international lists of people who should have their assets frozen. Now, how effective that ultimately is debatable, but that's where some improvement has been made. Hmm.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Douglas Farah. He has worked for the Washington Post as an investigative reporter and foreign correspondent. He was also the West Africa bureau chief for the Post, at which point he got onto this story about Al-Qaeda using the diamonds from Sierra Leone and Liberia to both as a way of funding their operations and as a way of storing their assets, banking their money, essentially, in a way that was easy to move around and very difficult to trace. If you're interested in reading about this, you can look for his book, Blood from Stones, The Secret Financial Network of Terror, Broadway Books is the publisher. Questions, of course, as always, are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. I think probably some people will be familiar with the concept of what has been called conflict diamonds or blood diamonds, the idea that in the places where the diamonds are produced, that people like Charles Taylor used the diamonds to fund their activities, that is to buy weaponry and to fuel regional conflicts in Africa. But this is a different thing. This raises the blood quotient on the diamonds to a sort of a whole new level. How is it that groups like first like Hezbollah and then later Al-Qaeda focused in on the possibility of taking advantage of the diamond trade for themselves and for their operations?
Well, it's a really interesting question. The Lebanese, there's a huge diaspora of the Lebanese community on the west coast of Africa that have traditionally controlled the diamond trade out of both Sierra Leone, and Liberia has not a very big diamond industry itself, but it's traditionally been a smuggling route out of Sierra Leone for Sierra Leonean diamonds. The first thing to understand is that the diamond mining there is extremely easy to do. It's alluvial mining, so you don't have to drill shafts or do anything like that. You essentially take a sifter and go into the riverbeds and sift the stones out looking for diamonds. So your total investment to get started as a small miner is $15 or $20, not the millions you need to do other types of diamond mining. And the Lebanese diaspora controlled the diamond industry from its inception in the 1930s. Graham Greene wrote about this in one of his early books based out of Sierra Leone on the diamond trade. It was essentially the same then. And as the Lebanese civil war heated up in the 80s, all the sides were financing themselves through Sierra Leonean diamonds because they had access to the diaspora community there who were willing to help them out. So it was not a strictly Islamic or Hezbollah operation. Over time, however, the Hezbollah remained the strongest and essentially took over the trade. But you also have a series of interconnected families or clans, if you will, that move diamonds for just about everyone in the region, from the Democratic Republic of Congo, Angola, Sierra Leone, Liberia. And that was the pipeline that the Al-Qaeda folks plugged into. They came along and simply put their product into the same pipeline that was moving the stones to Antwerp or Lebanon.
Hmm. Well, and I guess also there was a man who was involved in Sierra Leone who was an associate of Charles Taylor who had actually fought in Afghanistan, so that there was already this potential for setting up a connection between Taylor and his people and the fighters in Afghanistan, some of whom obviously became involved in Al-Qaeda.
No, that's a crucial part of how this happened, because Al-Qaeda doesn't blindly stumble around and seek to put his money into investment opportunities without knowing full well who they're dealing with and that they're people they can trust. And in this particular case, it was Ibrahim Ba, who was a Senegalese who had gone to Libya, then went as a mujahideen to Afghanistan in the mid-1980s, came back to Libya under Gaddafi's protection briefly, went to Lebanon and fought with Hezbollah, returned back to Libya as a trainer in one of the main terrorist camps that Gaddafi was running at the time for the West African forces. So he actually trained Charles Taylor himself, Fodi Sanko, the founder of the Revolutionary United Front, which was the rebel group in Sierra Leone that Taylor was allied with, Blaise Compaoré, the current president of Burkina Faso. So he was an extremely important person in this process. And when Al-Qaeda came in, it was through him. By the time they came in 1998, Ba had essentially established himself as the gatekeeper for all diamond deals in Liberia. You had to go through him to get to Taylor. And essentially, if you had enough money to come in and pay an upfront commission of $50,000 to $100,000, you could buy essentially a franchise in the diamond mining operations there. And because the Al-Qaeda folks knew Ba, trusted him, and came to see him, their franchise was opened.
Yeah. So what the rebels got from Al-Qaeda was they got money that they used then to go out and buy weapons. What Al-Qaeda got was they were able to put their money into this form that was very easily transportable and not traceable. So everybody came away happy.
Well, exactly. And, it's important to understand that this period of time, 1998, 1999, 2000, Liberia had essentially become, under Taylor, a functioning criminal enterprise, and you had not only the Al-Qaeda operatives and the Hezbollah operatives there, you had Victor Boot, the largest illegal weapons merchant in the world, had registered all his planes there and was taking payment in diamonds while he was flying weapons into Liberia, Angola. He was flying for the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan and the Taliban. He was a very versatile figure. You had Lenoid Menin, one of the main illicit diamond and weapons dealers in the world at the time, was seeking shelter in Liberia. You had Ukrainian organized crime, Russian organized crime, South African organized crime, all set up there. So it really was essentially, you know, a Disneyland of criminal and terrorist organizations.
Yeah. So it certainly wasn't just Hezbollah. It wasn't Al-Qaeda. All kinds of people around the world were looking at that and seeing what kind of opportunity there was.
Well, a state that can issue you diplomatic passports that are still recognized around the world, or issue you valid airplane registrations, even though there are no inspections carried out and you do it, you know, for $150 a plane, or can offer you banking facilities, or can offer you new identities, or end-user certificates for the purchase of weapons, you know, it's a beautiful thing. So that's, I think, failed states or these sort of gray stateless areas that are growing around the world are key havens where people will seek shelter because they offer all these advantages.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you wrote about this for the Post. This story ran in the fall of 2001 and it got a lot of coverage. Was that the reason that you had to leave?
Yes, after I wrote the initial story, I knew Taylor and folks would be upset about it. I dealt with Taylor extensively in my coverage of Liberia and understood how angry he would be, but I wasn't expecting it to go to the next level. But shortly after the story ran, the U.S. Embassy in Abidjan, the regional security officer, called me in and showed me a classified cable which said there are, you know, serious efforts to seek retribution against me for this story. And my initial inclination, having been covering wars and things for a long time, was to maybe just lie low for a little while. But then a British intelligence service called my editors at the Post and said, "Get him out of there. They're going to kill him." At which point the Post called me and said, "Get out of there." So we did. I had a 2-year-old son, and my wife was pregnant with my second child at the time. So it didn't seem like a good time to try to make a heroic stand.
Well, also, apparently what happened is that at the time the story ran, that the government of the United States said, "We don't know anything about this. We don't know anything about Al-Qaeda and diamonds." And they then, in order to make up for the fact that they really were not clued into this, they actually, instead of really getting on the real story, they got after you.
Well, it was a fascinating experience as a U.S. citizen how this happened, because as a reporter, I had dealt with the CIA for many years on different issues. I had never gone to them and briefed them as they asked me to do in this particular case, and my feeling was maybe this could save lives. So I briefed them on how I got the initial story without giving away my sources, but something I wouldn't normally do, only with the interest of giving them more information. And what turned out later, as the attacks by them against my character and my reporting sort of increased, was what I finally found out was that there had been at least two occasions where they were warned prior to 9/11 about the use of diamonds and weapons trade. It did not connect it directly to Al-Qaeda, but certainly the Hezbollah connection was made for them, and the fact that these diamonds were being used to buy weapons for a war that, you have to understand, even by African standards, was particularly brutal. The RUF signature atrocity was the amputation of the arms and legs of men, women, and children from 2 years old up to 70 years old. The systematic use of widespread rape in the areas they controlled of thousands and thousands of women, and the abduction of children and forcing them not only into their ranks, but often to kill their own families, and then keeping them on drugs for extended periods of time and turning them into killing machines. So it wasn't a normal war that these diamonds and weapons were flowing through. It was one of the ones where some of the worst atrocities on the continent were being committed. And they had essentially told the people who came with this information, "We're not interested. Thank you very much. Take a hike." And I think ultimately it was the embarrassment over those missed opportunities that drove them to try to discredit the story.
Mm-hmm. And just for additional background for people, there is a a war crimes tribunal has been set up in Sierra Leone to try people in connection with these events that we've been talking about. And one of the people that they want to try is Charles Taylor, who at the moment is in exile in Nigeria. And there's been some question about whether or not he can be extradited, will go to Sierra Leone for trial. Is that a story that you have continued to follow?
Yes, very closely. And in fact, one of the things that has been most helpful to me is that the special court, in doing their investigations into the crimes against humanity, which is their charter, have been asking people and collecting documents on the Al-Qaeda connection, which is they've gone even further than I did in my initial findings. They've identified two additional senior-level Al-Qaeda people as having been over a long period of time in Liberia and working with Taylor. And they verified, the great substance of my story through completely independent means, which has been very useful for me in sort of helping fend off the attacks, particularly because the prosecutor and the chief investigator are both longtime Department of Defense, the U.S. Department of Defense JAGs. And so they have great credibility and they're very, very frustrated at the inability to get at Taylor because clearly he was the brains behind the plot that brought this really horrific level of death and destruction to this little corner of the world.
Mm. Well, how involved was Al-Qaeda with Taylor? Was that more than simply this business arrangement that said, well, we'll give you money, you give us diamonds, and then we'll each go our separate ways and follow our interests from there?
My sense is that Taylor may not have even known who they were. If Ba had okayed them, then he was willing to do business with them, and they did pay their upfront fee. Where it becomes a little harder to know what he knew is in the period before 9/11, particularly the summer before 9/11, Al-Qaeda was meeting with the RUF leadership, which seldom happened without Taylor's explicit endorsement, and asking them to mine more diamonds and offering to buy all the diamonds they could mine and paying a small premium over the going rate for the stone so they could essentially have a monopoly on that stone harvest, because the way the mining goes in Sierra Leone, because it's alluvial, it starts in April, May when the rains start, then really picks up through the summer when the rains are heavy, and then tapers off again toward the end there into the fall. And that chunk in the middle is what Al-Qaeda had a virtual monopoly on. And for that to happen, it seems to me that Taylor had to at least have some knowledge of who they were or check them out a little bit.
Mm. We're a little bit past our midpoint here in this hour of Focus 580, and again, our guest is Douglas Farah, who's done a lot of reporting for The Washington Post, particularly on this particular story, and that is the financing of international terrorism. He has written a book on this. It's entitled Blood from Stones, The Secret Financial Network of Terror. It is published by Broadway Books, and it is in large part based on some of the reporting that he did in West Africa when he was bureau chief there for The Washington Post, particularly focusing on this on the diamond and illegal arms trade there and the fact that Al-Qaeda used that as a way of financing its operations and also taking money and transferring it into this form, the diamonds, that were very easy to transport and difficult to trace. And then, of course, then that money went in and fueled the civil wars that went on there in Sierra Leone, Liberia, killed an awful lot of people. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455. We do also have the toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here. Champaign County, we'll go there, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, how much did you investigate the other end where the diamonds are cashed in? I guess you're going to say that they can be so anonymous, but isn't there a system now of trying to follow blood diamonds more? And it seems like if there had been more seriousness in trying to stop Liberian diamonds for its own sake, for what it was doing in Liberia, that if that more attention had been paid to that in Amsterdam and New York, that it wouldn't have been as open a prospect for Al-Qaeda to use it in the fashion they have.
Well, there's no question that until the Kimberley process, which just recently kicked in, came along, there was virtually no scrutiny of the diamond trade whatsoever, and you could take diamonds into, especially where these diamonds were going, principally Antwerp and then into Lebanon also. Some of them went straight over there. Dubai in the United Arab Emirates is also a large diamond market and accessible and comfortable for the Al-Qaeda operatives at the time to work in. But there was no scrutiny whatsoever of those diamonds. And even the Kimberley process, which requires certificates from the countries to say these are not blood diamonds, is not going to be overly effective in slowing this down. What has to change is on the buyer's end, the willingness to actually look at the stones. And about a year after my main story ran, the BBC did a follow-up documentary where, and at the end of it, after identifying the same things I had in the same terrorist operations, etc., they smuggled diamonds back into Europe. And they went to the jewelry store and said, "We have diamonds from Sierra Leone. They're blood diamonds. We don't have any certificate." Not one diamond dealer turned them down. So it's a huge problem.
Mm-hmm. I don't expect a technical fix to solve anything, really, but is the Kimberley process looking at, sort of analysis, ways of chemical analysis, of ways of looking for origins and establishing that?
They say the diamond industry says that's virtually impossible to do. What they're looking at is doing laser etching in an individual stone that would identify it as being okay, and that you could only, wouldn't harm the quality of the stone. That sort of stuff, which is also very expensive. What it basically, I think, ultimately, rather than regulation, you have to work with the diamond community to take action against suspect activities that they know exist. Regulation, I don't think, ultimately will matter much.
Mm. A modest proposal is just the diamond industry ought to collapse because it's a bit of a
it's a
farce.
Sham anyway. That's
a bit of a farce anyway. There's another caller. I'll listen. Thanks.
Okay. Others certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have toll-free line that's good anyway that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And you can give us a call. Just to follow up on what you were talking about there at the end with the caller, there has been some attention drawn to this issue of the blood diamonds. You've written about it and other reporters have written about it. Has the world demand for diamonds slacked any, or are there significant numbers of consumers who are saying, this is something that's important to me, and if I actually have that much money and I'm going to go out to be buying diamonds, I want to know where they came from?
The diamond sales have actually increased in the last couple of years rather significantly, I think at about a 7% rate or something. So people are not shying away from diamonds in light of this reporting. I think to its credit, the diamond industry is looking and trying to take serious measures on some of this. The shame of being associated with terrorist financing is a very high price to pay, and I think that what they have feared, what they've told me they fear, is a boycott similar to the fur boycotts that really hurt the fur industry. And so they've been moving fairly aggressively to deal with this, and in a couple months ago at the big World Diamond Council meeting in Dubai, the head of De Beers, which has a virtual monopoly on diamonds, in his speech acknowledged the vulnerability in the fact that terrorists had been using them and their need to really crack down, which was an amazing thing for the diamond industry to admit publicly. So I think that there are some efforts there, but I don't think it's really damaged their market at all yet.
Yeah. Well, we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that you had done this story and it got a lot of national attention, and that the government said, well, we don't know anything about Al-Qaeda and diamonds, and then later on you found out that, in fact, the CIA had some opportunities to follow up on this and didn't, and then instead of dealing with their mistakes, tried to discredit you and some other people who were reporting on this issue. So what does all of this tell us about the CIA and its ability to gather important intelligence information when it comes to terrorism?
Well, my initial reaction in dealing with them and what I told them, and I believe it was true, it was not a matter of stupidity or incompetence on the ground necessarily in West Africa. After the Cold War ended, West Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, suffered the bulk of the huge cuts that were implemented in the intelligence budget, and they shut down more than a third of their stations. Those stations that remained were minimally manned, and I knew a couple of the station chiefs in the region, and they were almost single-handedly covering two or three countries, which meant they couldn't possibly have any idea what was going on in the bush in Sierra Leone and Liberia, Burkina Faso. They weren't equipped to do that. So I think the first thing is to get intelligence gathering on the ground there. But I also think it shows a cultural deficiency in the intelligence community, and that is the inability to, one, admit missed opportunities, perhaps, and two is to go after stories that they or information they don't own to begin with. If they didn't produce it, then they don't believe it. And I think that's a very, very dangerous way of looking at the world, especially in this day and age. Mm.
Well, just last week, the director of Central Intelligence resigned, he said that it was for personal reasons, but it seems that nobody in Washington believed that everybody was expecting that there were coming soon reports that would be very critical of the CIA, the 9/11 Commission, and others, and that he was getting out before it hit the fan. So there are a lot of people seem to be lining up to criticize the CIA and the way that it has operated. What do you think can be done or could be done to try to improve its operation so that it would do a better job of getting the kind of intelligence that we need?
Well, I think in my experience of dealing with them and then in the recent months in studying them and dealing with them rather closely, I think the fundamental thing that has to shift is despite the years that have passed and the new world order, the intelligence community remains very focused on state threats, and they understand perhaps China, maybe North Korea, Russia. What they still have very little understanding of is non-state actors. It sounds academic-y, but essentially militias, terrorist groups, guerrilla groups that control increasing swaths of the world where no state can effectively operate. Those, to me, are the real threats in the area where we still have very, very little information, understanding of how it works, or resources on the ground, or a desire to put resources on the ground. And to me, that is a tremendously serious mistake, or at least a tremendously serious slowdown in our ability to get a handle on how these groups work and be able to get at them, because as long as those gray areas exist, that's where they'll be. And, for example, if you look at the Democratic Republic of Congo, no one knows what happens in two-thirds of that enormous country in the heart of Africa, which has uranium, diamonds, timber, iron, aluminum, or bauxite, any number of very valuable commodities, and we have no understanding of what happens in those areas. There's, for example, I do know there are flights that fly directly from the Bujimai diamond mines to Dubai at least once a week without going through customs or filing flight manifests or anything like that. What does that mean? Who's on those planes? What are they being used for? We don't know. And I think that's what we have to start getting a handle on.
And that's not just an issue for CIA, but perhaps other areas of government too, and also for media to try to pay more attention to what's going on in Africa and perhaps other places like that are maybe difficult to get into, difficult to understand, don't get a whole lot of coverage, and yet there's this same opportunity for all kinds of things that if we knew about them would distress us for going on there.
I think that's absolutely right. I think you're touching on the media and the shrinking attention of the already very limited attention to places like Africa in both the print media and electronic media is truly alarming. I mean, when I left Abidjan, the Post closed that bureau down and essentially I moved it to Afghanistan, and now we only have two instead of three bureaus in Africa, and other eight companies and newspapers have even less there. It's truly alarming because these are vital areas that in many ways will become, I believe, a true national security interest for the United States, and without any coverage from the media, people won't know that here, and there'll be a great lack of understanding.
Hmm. Well, so the Post only has two bureaus in Africa now. Where are they?
One is in Kenya and one is in South Africa.
Yeah.
I believe that only the New York Times still has three bureaus there. Everybody else has one and maybe two, but it's very limited.
Mm-hmm. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Douglas Farah, has been a reporter for The Washington Post, was the West Africa bureau chief there. He is the author of the book Blood from Stones, The Secret Financial Network of Terror, and Broadway Books is the publisher. It's out in the bookstore now if you would like to look at it. Right now, he is involved as a consultant and senior fellow at something called the National Strategy Information Center. What is the National Strategy Information Center all about?
It's a small foundation that has been around for about 40 years and has done an enormous amount of work on intelligence reform and looking at what can be done to reform the intelligence community, both during the Cold War and then especially in the post-Cold War era, trying to make specific recommendations on what the intelligence community can do better.
And are you expecting that at some point you're going to go back to the Post?
I'm on leave from the Post. I have another 6 months to decide whether I like life outside better than inside there.
Okay. We have another caller here to talk with. Interbana, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hello. You mentioned a couple of terrorist organizations in one or two countries. How widespread is this this whole phenomenon in terms of other organizations and other countries being involved?
Are you referring to the diamond trade, or what are you referring to there?
This whole finance through precious commodities.
Well, the other case that has been traced extensively is the use of tanzanite by Al-Qaeda specifically, which is only found in Tanzania, a little corner of Tanzania in East Africa. There are a lot of indications that the diamond mining industry in southern Africa has also been used by different terrorist organizations, including Hezbollah, again, extensively because of the Lebanese connection there. But they've used emeralds in Afghanistan itself. They were a main source of finance both for the Northern Alliance and for the Taliban. They fought over the emerald area extensively and went back and forth on that. If you're looking at broader ways in which they can, which terrorist finance work, and through commodities and shipping and false invoicing, if you broaden the definition out of into organized criminal groups and that do drug trafficking like the FARC in Colombia, then you're talking probably most countries in the world involved. If you're talking limited to Al Qaeda and commodities and maybe Hezbollah, I would say most of that is in Africa.
Is tanzanite used to make diamonds?
Tanzanite is a precious stone, semi-precious stone. It became very famous after the movie The Titanic came out because the pendant that the woman wore was made out of was tanzanite. But it's a deep blue precious stone.
So are they actually using that for revenue?
They were using that, yes. A colleague of mine at the Wall Street Journal, Bobby Block, and the now unfortunately deceased Daniel Pearl did a long investigation into that. And found that they were mining the diamonds, selling it to imams in the diamond mining area that were passing the money on to Al Qaeda. Yes.
So what about storage and transport in terms of is it mostly gems or do they use gold and things like that?
Well, the gold is a different they use it for a different purpose, but they use gold extensively because gold is a value that they understand and a medium of exchange that they understand, and it's also very stable around the world. And what you found, in my reporting in Afghanistan and Pakistan, as the U.S. troops went in, the Taliban and Al Qaeda essentially gathered up all the revenue out of all the banks, and what they had accumulated was gold. They had been paid gold for their opium crops. They had been paid gold by transporters who wanted to open the highways going through there. They collected enormous amount of their functioning budget in gold, and they simply took that out to Dubai, which is the gold capital of the world. And from Dubai, you can move it in kind, any place in the globe, around the globe. And one of the people involved in that was the same guy who was in Liberia, Victor Boot, who was also involved in the gold transfers. So it's not exactly the same type of thing, but gold is, yes, a very, very well known to them and a commodity they like a lot.
So okay, one more question. I'll hang up. Are the diamonds used only as revenue, or are they also an alternate form of exchange?
I don't know if they're an alternate form of exchange. What they do is take them and then in small parcels sell them. They take the rough stones and polish them and sell them to be polished. So they're not getting the highest market value there, because usually they have only at least maybe one polished face or no polished faces. So they're not selling polished stones on the market. They're taking the rough stones to brokers that they trust in Dubai and Antwerp and Lebanon, and selling them for the cash they need for whatever they need at that particular point. So you can sell small amounts of diamonds, obviously, without having the market show any impact at all, and that's what they do.
All right. Well, that's very informative. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. We'll go to another caller here. This is Belgium, a nearby community here. Line 4. Hello.
Good morning. I'm sure in this discussion you have mentioned the fact that diamonds really are not rare. They're very, very, with the opening of new mines in Canada, northern Canada, the market has a lot of them. They're artificially held high by De Beers just so they can stay rich. It seems as though we can solve this problem a lot by forcing De Beers to charge the real price for diamonds, not the inflated flat price that they want. Obviously, the only way we can do that is to reduce demand.
Well, I think someone has written a book that I've glanced through, and I don't have his name in mind, about the most successful advertising campaign in history, and it certainly is De Beers and diamonds. That you're absolutely right. They have stockpiles of diamonds that could last for many, many years now, and they deliberately withhold it from the market, and it's an artificial cartel set up where they put out stones to keep demand very high. So if that is viewed as a problem, then there are probably ways of forcing De Beers to lessen its market share and open up a little more. But you're absolutely right. It's an artificially produced system of artificially high value for stones that are not that rare. And even if they were rare, there are enough stones stored that you could supply the diamond market for at least a decade without mining another stone. So you're absolutely right.
If you really want to get your loved one a valuable stone, get them an emerald. Emeralds are far more valuable per carat weight. Thank you very much.
Okay, right, thank you.
Thanks for the call. I guess it does come down to the interesting fact that here, when we're talking about emeralds or diamonds or gold for that matter, that it's not something that has intrinsic value. It's only something that's valuable because we've decided that it is.
Yes, that's true. It's a strange world indeed.
Yeah. We have just a couple of minutes left, and I guess I'm interested. We have talked a little bit about intelligence reform, and I'm just interested maybe in finishing up and giving you the opportunity to talk just a little bit more about that. As I mentioned a little earlier, no doubt we're going to hear a lot more. There already has been criticism of not only the CIA but other American intelligence agencies, and we'll be hearing more, I'm sure, this summer. After the 9/11 Commission report is released and others about what should be done, how intelligence could be improved, how communication between the various agencies that in the past have been very jealous of their turf and have not wanted to exchange information, is there some way to get them to work more closely together? Is there now in Washington any really kind of coherent thinking about what could be done to improve the gathering and the analysis of intelligence information?
Well, I think what you have is a consensus that something has to be done. I don't think there's any consensus on what that actually means, and that's a shame, because in the absence of specific proposals, people will revert back to their traditional operating ways, and we may lose a chance to really have effective and deep intelligence reform simply because there's a lack of vision of what that means besides the rhetoric of it. Clearly, there is a consensus that there were major intelligence failures now. And there's a consensus that the community is not serving us as best it could. The question is, will they tinker again with organizational boxes and budgets and just push things around a little bit, or will they look at the underlying culture that needs to be changed to make the intelligence community more adaptable to this rapidly changing world? And I don't know if there's any consensus to go that far.
We have this man, this position in Washington that's known as the Director of Central Intelligence, who is the head of the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. But there is also this idea, although I don't think that's ever actually been honored, that that person is supposed to indeed be the director of intelligence and have a kind of oversight role over all of the intelligence gathering, which I'm not sure has actually ever been true. One of the things, though, that people have suggested is maybe that what we ought to do is make the director of Central Intelligence the true director of American intelligence and elevate that position past the point of just heading the CIA, but it being some kind of intelligence czar. Is that something that anybody is talking about? And does anybody think that even if such a thing could happen, and chances are Washington being the kind of place it is, it wouldn't, but if such a thing could happen, whether that would make any difference?
Well, in reality, the CIA has about less than 30% of the intelligence budget. The Pentagon owns the vast bulk of the intelligence budget for the NSA and the host of its own intelligence gathering operations. So it is a bit of a misnomer to believe the CIA is solely responsible in doing this and has control of how intelligence is gathered and disseminated. There is a lot of talk about trying to create sort of an intelligence czar, whether it be in Homeland Security or out of the CIA, and how that would all fit together. My guess is that you're right in assuming that given the absence of President Bush to address this publicly and sort of articulate a plan in which to move people in an environment where you can actually accomplish something, probably it won't go that way. I would just guess that we're not going to see truly deep reforms. I think we'll see personnel changes and maybe a little bit of, you know, shuffling the organizational boxes, but without really looking at who you recruit, how you recruit, where you put people on the ground, and what your actual intelligence collection priorities are, I'm not sure that that's going to happen.
Hmm. One of the things that we've heard more about and as a complicating factor on gathering intelligence in Iraq, perhaps, was the idea that in defense, in the Pentagon, Mr. Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, wasn't real happy with what he was getting from the CIA and decided to set up his own mini CIA that, again, also may have yielded bad information. Has that undercut the CIA?
I think it clearly undercut the CIA in some quarters, and it's clear that Director Tenet felt that he was being stepped around, and the fact that you had people making decisions based on people who were specifically looking at the CIA intelligence with great skepticism certainly didn't help it. I'm not sure how long that will last. I think there is an agreement that you have to have a more coherent approach to how you gather and disseminate your intelligence in this very dangerous sort of time in the world, and I don't think that independent shops are going to be tolerated much longer.
Mm. Well, there we'll stop. We have to end it. Our guest, Douglas Farah, is currently on leave from the Washington Post. He is now senior fellow at the National Strategy Information Center, writing on national intelligence matters. If you're interested in reading his book on this whole business of the financing of terrorism, it's titled Blood from Stones, The Secret Financial Network of Terror, and it's published by Broadway Books. And Mr. Farah, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
The broadcast today is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, imported foods from around the world, featuring a selection of international European cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, and more. World Harvest Foods at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. That's it for us. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Gwynn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk with writer Rachel Cohen about her journey into American history, arts, and letters. She's the author of A Chance Meeting, Intertwined Lives of American Writers and Artists, 1854 to 1967. She joins us following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at prices on the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. July wheat, 365. That's up 2. September wheat, 374.5, up 3/4. July corn, 298.5, down 1.75. September, 299.75, down 2.75. December corn, 3 even, that down 3.5. March corn, 304.